Shot him in the back, 'cause it's a crime to be black. And don't you act surprised when it gets vandalized. So call it what it is, call it what it is, call it what it is, murder.
You're here on another episode of the White Privilege Podcast. You're a very white guy host, and I'm joined again this week with Sean J. Jordan. We're hoping to make this a permanent coupling, but you can find the White Privilege Podcast on our website, Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. You can also find us on most places where apps and podcasts can be found, iTunes, Stitcher. We're on Facebook, Tumblr. Again, I'm at Very White Guy, and Sean's at Sean J. Jordan, J-O-R-D-A-N. And today we're going to be talking about media narratives and framing of media narratives, and in particular with regards to victims of extrajudicial killings, people of color, and what we as individuals that want to deconstruct supremacy and racism in our systems and ourselves, non-people of color that support the Black Lives Matter, what we can do to kind of help combat and change this sort of issue of media narratives. So, Sean, thank you once again for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on again. And as you said, I hope that we can make this a regular thing. There's so many issues to talk about, and this has been a wonderful chance to air some of those and really help to let people know what's been going on, not just in St. Louis, where I live, but just in the broader culture. Thank you.
No, and I think I've said this before. I'm selfishly using this podcast as somewhat catharsis. You know, I work from home. I'm by myself. You know, some of this work within the space is, I wouldn't say solitary, but depending on how and what you're doing, at least the space that I'm at, again, because I'm from home, a lot of times just doing things by myself. So I really do enjoy having time and opportunity to talk with you. And I'm married to a woman of color, and there's even, I wouldn't say often, but instances where, you know, I don't want to burden her with, you know, white bullshit. So I'm glad we have this space together. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about media narratives. And if anyone hopefully listened to our podcast from, I think it was about a week ago, we talked about the research came out a year ago from the Race Forward group, Color Lines. And essentially, our podcast last time was about that research. But the long and the short was, man, does the media do a really poor job when it comes to differentiating between individual and systemic or institutionalized racism. And as they were talking about how poor of a job that the media does, they used a couple of different, I think, appropriate to remind folks terms. And one is sort of the frame. So what is the frame of reference? What's the perspective? And for a lot of media, it's primarily white, frequently white male. So what's the frame that this is coming from? What's the narrative that frame uses for this story, and then what's the message that comes from that story? So I think, in fact, I know very little. I was in a meeting last night, and I'd like to write a podcast about that experience another time, but was at a meeting and didn't see anything until I got in until almost midnight and saw, I don't say unbelievably because it is believable, but there was another officer involved killing of a person of color in sort of the St. Louis Ferguson area. It's Ladarius Williams, correct?
Well, that is correct. And tell me if you've heard this one before. Okay, so we have a young black male in the St. Louis area in what's called South City. He is walking down the street, minding his own business, when suddenly he's approached by a cop, and he is thought to have a weapon, so he takes off running, and they chase him into an alleyway and claim that he hides behind a bush, and then a few minutes later, they wind up shooting him dead right there, and then sealing off the area, and as protesters form all around them. They refuse to answer any questions. They leave blood on the ground for people to take pictures of afterwards. If this story sounds familiar, it's because it's almost identical to what happened back in October in the Shaw neighborhood to Vonder and Myers. Yeah. And this same narrative played out just yesterday in St. Louis with just a couple of miles from where Von Rittmeyer was killed in October with Ladarius Williams. That happened in daylight this time. It didn't happen at night. And it happened with on-duty cops, not off-duty cops, but otherwise a lot of really similar details. And one of the most similar details was that the chief of police, Chief Sam Dotson, who we in the protest community have had a lot of issues with, his ability to tell the truth, immediately yesterday, before the victim's name was even released, Dotson was out saying, oh, this individual was known to police. We were familiar with him. He had weapons charges before. Basically implying that before we even tell you the facts, you need to know this guy was guilty. And Dotson had played the same playbook back when Von Rittmeyer was shot in October. So it's really alarming and difficult to hear almost the same story being used to justify yet another young black man in the St. Louis area.
Yeah, and you know, and what you there's a lot of this sort of framing and narrative, but what you've described, and it's just it's so consistent, and it, you know, it's a playbook, and it's page one of the victimization of the smearing of the victim, right? Of making the individual that's been killed, smearing their character. And it's just every single blasted time. And it's like clockwork. You know, I know as soon as someone dies, within 24 hours, I'm going to know more about their past behavior and run-ins and potential run-ins with the law. I'm going to know more about their behavior in the past than anything related to what happened that evening that ended up with their death. And we're here in Philadelphia. We've got Brandon Tate Brown. It's been almost 2 months. He was killed in December. You know, not similar, but again, sort of weird circumstances. He's pulled over. They said his headlights weren't on, but they were on. He was in the car. Then he was out of the car. Then he was on the other side of the car. They say he dove in to get a gun out of the glove box. I mean, all this crazy stuff. And they've said nothing. We don't even know the officer that was involved in the shooting. The individual's mother, Tanya Brown, she's at like every one of these protest actions. She's, you know, it just breaks your heart seeing her out there, you know, whether it's cold, doesn't matter what day of the week, she is out there trying to find out information on her son. And I've heard her tell, you know, a version of this incident multiple times. And it literally, her son worked for a rental car company. And when the news came out that the black man in this neighborhood shot by police and there was a rental car, she knew it. She knew it. She goes, oh, my, you know, it's Brandon. I know it's Brandon. So she's calling around. She had to call like five or six different, Philly's got some weird, the way that we divide our precincts up. So she had to call multiple places. And when she finally got the right precinct, and I'll call them out, it's the 15th precinct, PS2. She says, did you kill my son? And they said, yes. And to date, over almost 2 months, that is the sole and only information she's received. I mean, just really. And just like with Ladarius, we know everything about Brandon's past. You know, the police have gone out on TV and said all kinds of, you know, he did this and he did. And I'm not trying to, you know, wash it over. He'd spent some time in prison. He, you know, made a mistake, was turned his life around. But it drives me just absolutely bonkers. You know, that every single time, play one, page one is why this individual deserved to die. And it just, I don't see how white people and I don't see how media don't see it and stop participating in it.
Well, and with Brandon Tate Brown, it was particularly upsetting that he was in the midst of turning his life around. Yeah. He's someone who had gone to prison and had reformed, and he was really excited about the new direction that his life was taking. And it wasn't the media that would push that narrative. It was some of the people involved in the protest community who went and looked at his social media profiles and talked to people that knew him and who found out that he was starting a new job. He was really excited. He was feeling like he was in a positive place in his life. And then all of a sudden his life is ended by two police officers who stop him in the middle of the night and murder him. I don't use that word lightly, but that appears to be what they did. Over fear that he might have had a gun, and it's not even established that they even had seen a gun because they killed him before they even searched his car.
And he was
for the media to push the story that he had done all these terrible things, and not to push the positive story that this is a guy who was getting his life together, and there was a lot of suspicion about why he even needed to be killed by police in the first place. they never jump to that. They always jump to the horrible stuff that confirms, you know, unfortunately, what an awful lot of white people do think about black people. And that's part of the problem, is that the media is reinforcing these awful stereotypes and making it harder for the black community to really come out and speak up about these incidents, because when they see themselves being vilified, I mean, from the moment that one of their own is killed, then it just makes it that much harder to want to stand up and say anything other than in outrage and in protest.
Yeah, and I'll reiterate, you know, Brandon was shot in the back of the head. I don't see how that's not murder. And, you know, with this the smearing of the victim, like you're talking about, and this breaks my heart, but I see it not just from the media, not just from, you know, sort of the, what you've described. I usually say there's white folk have implicit bias. You know, we implicitly have this bias about people of color, inherently, you know, bad or criminal. And then these things come out that kind of confirm that bias. Like there's a spoon-fed cycle to it. But with Brandon Tate Brown, even here in Philadelphia, within, you know, some of the there's different groups, you know, we're all kind of working in different ways. Within some of the activist community, there's still some sort of, you know, you feel a weird kind of like he's not the right victim, you know, like Rosa Parks versus Claudette Colvin, because he had a criminal past. And it just, it bristles me to no end, because that is so antithetical to what I think is the perfect mission statement and mantra for this movement, Black Lives Matter. It's not some black lives. It's not, you know, a couple of black lives. It's not Black Lives Matter also. It's just plain and simple, Black Lives Matter. And so it's tough. And with Brandon in particular, you're right. The posts he had on social media within, I think, that same day weren't just about turning his life around. It was, you know, I'm excited. I've got a job. He was working at a fast food place. And he said, I'm going to, you know, I'm thrilled. I'm home. I'm with my family. I'm, you know, I'm never going to, you know, go back. I'm going to sling that grease forever. And to make it clear for people that are listening, because that, you know, he did go to jail for a period of time. He had a girlfriend, might have been the mother of his child, who was attacked and was brutally beat by another man. And he protected her, and he probably did so a little bit too vociferously, right? There's a, you know, that fight or flight, you're in a mentality, you know, my girl, mother, my child's being, you know, attacked. And so he beat this man, and he paid the price for that. He went to jail. So even, you know, people say, oh, he's a criminal, he went to jail. It's like, no, I mean, even that's kind of a fucked up narrative. He was protecting his family and a woman that he loves. And because he's black, he paid the price for that. You know, I could, if it were me and I beat the crap out of somebody that laid hands on my wife, no way I would have gone to jail for 5 years. I'm white. I've got money. I can get a lawyer. Wouldn't have been the same. Wouldn't have been the same. So even the, you know, the sort of framing of the narrative that he's a criminal, has a past, we're kind of forgetting, like, well, but, you know, why? And just, it drives me nuts. So let's, I want to talk more about Ladarius, because I'll be honest, I'm totally out of the loop. I saw Basm had some live streams. I think I saw that perhaps the police had an altercation with Ladarius previously, and had he even been shot by the police before? I'm very out of the loop, so I'm hoping you can fill me and our listeners in.
Well, let's unpack what happened a little bit. So first of all, we have to go back to 2009, because that was where Ladarius had his first big encounter with the police. Now, he was at the time 17 years old, and the way the police have described the situation is that even then he was known to them. Now, what known to them means is really nebulous, and in fact, that's something we're going to need to come back to here in a few minutes. But he was known to them at the time, and at 17, during a stop, he fled and apparently had a gun, and a police officer shot him and wounded him, and he wound up going to jail for armed assault. And he actually had he was given 2 7-year sentences, but he was let out earlier this year, which is 8 years early. And actually, the details of why he was let out are kind of in dispute. And I was actually reading a pretty good article written about this on Daily Coast, which I will provide the link to this and any other articles we reference for the show notes.
Great.
This article was written by a guy named Ryder Redman, and he was talking about how when he's searching public records, the public records are so apathetic that they don't even list what happened. You know, did he get paroled? Did he just get let out? You know, was he on probation? What was going on? So we're not actually sure why he was let out, but he was let out in March earlier this year, and hadn't had any real incidents with police. but or excuse me, March of last year, 2014. I keep forgetting that we changed years. And we're not exactly sure why police chose to stop him yesterday. They haven't said. All they have said was he was known to police, whatever that means. And when they stopped him, you know, and saw him clutching at his waistband, that was when they decided they needed to pursue him. And the way that Chief Dotson described what happened was that they caught him behind a bush and that he pulled a weapon out, and they struggled for their lives with him, trying to get the gun out of his hand. And as soon as the gun was pointed at one of the other officer stood back and fired 4 shots and killed him. Well, there are a few problems with the story that the police told. There isn't a dispute that there was a gun on the scene. In fact, some of the protesters that made the scene early did get pictures of the gun he was alleged to have. But there is dispute about quite how the story worked out. For one thing, they chased him down what's called the gangway, and this is an older section of St. Louis. They've got row houses, and they said he was hiding behind a bush, but I'll tell you, if you watch Dasm's archive stream or if you look at some of the pictures that were taken, there are no leaves on any of the bushes in that area. And those bushes are not out in the concrete gangways, which are kind of like alleyways between you know, the different rows of houses. So it would be very, very difficult for someone to try to hide behind a bush.
Certainly wouldn't be a
police officer.
It wouldn't be a choice of where to hide, is what you're saying. It wasn't a very effective hiding space.
It would be a very strange way to try to disguise yourself if you're running for your life from police that you believe might harm you. And we've also learned, not from the police themselves, but from Ladarius' brother, who appeared on Bassam's stream yesterday, that the police officer that shot Ladarius and killed him yesterday was the same officer that shot him 4 years ago. And they have a nickname for the guy. They call him Worm. Not entirely sure what the details are there, but that is what Ladarius's brother has been saying. So there is some question as well as why police were motivated to stop him, if it had something to do with this history that they had. Because the first time they arrested him back in 2009, they did shoot him. They just didn't kill him. This time, they shot him in such a way that he was rushed to the hospital and died there. So it was a much more fatal altercation this time over very similar non-incident that seemed to trigger it.
And, you know, that sounds so much like here in New Jersey. There was an individual, Jeremy Reed, that was killed. There's so many, you just fucking lose track. But Jeremy was killed and was likewise killed by an officer that had, you know, interacted and arrested him and, you know, maybe sent him to prison previously. And you just, you know, it's like, I don't want to say that there's always nefarious as that. So I don't know. I don't know all the answers, but just putting myself in either of these individual shoes, my God, I'd be so just afraid. You know, here's a man with a gun that literally shot you and sent you to prison on assault charges, and you were looking at 14 years, you know, regardless of what happens in those moments. You know, these individuals have to just be unfortunately petrified. Why are the police so afraid of them? You know, it's nuts.
And on Dasm's live stream, there was a moment where Ladarius's brother is trying to talk to a reporter from one of the local news sources, and gets really angry and doesn't want to talk to her. And he starts yelling, "This is why, you know, we all carry guns. We're afraid of this. We're terrified of this. They're killing us. We have to carry guns to protect ourselves." And he's talking about the police. He's pointing over at the police that are standing there trying to ignore the fact that there are family members and neighbors of this victim that want to know what happened. Ladarius's brother just gets so upset he doesn't even want to talk to the reporter because she's white and she doesn't understand. And she's asking him really silly questions from his point of view. Here he is, you know, dealing with the death of his actual brother, and she's going, "Now, you mean, when you say brother, you mean he's your actual brother, right?" You know, she's just asking him these inane and silly questions while he's processing that someone has just been killed by the police from his family. Just the emotion that goes into that, and the feeling, the overpowering urge to feel like you need to strike back, but knowing that you can't. I can only imagine what these folks are going through.
Yeah. And I've spoke about this on other podcasts and places. For me as a white male, I have to really combat, you know, my history of 40 some odd years has been when I am backed up, I'm in a corner, when there's a fear, when there's a, you know, some sort of inclination that I'm being attacked in any way, just even remotely. It can be a pseudo fear in my mind. It's like a fight or flight reflex. It gets switched on, and it's my male white privilege. I go right to anger because in the past, like, you know, I could get angry and shout and, you know, stomp my feet, and I'd get my, like, a, you know, crying little baby. I get my way, and I have to really combat that. Like, in situations, it's like, oh, wait a minute. You know, this is my first sort of knee jerk reaction, is to be upset and angry. And I can. I'm very fortunate that I can do that, and there are not consequences. Somebody's not going to say, oh, that's angry, you know, white guy. Oh, look at him, you know, what an angry jerk. He's acting like a thug and an animal. No one will say that, because angry white guy is just sort of like, okay, it's normal. It's expected. It works. But angry black guy gets killed, you know?
Well, and I think there's an even deeper point that we, sitting in our privilege, need to understand, and that is, we as white people, especially as white males, are allowed to make mistakes. We are allowed to do things that are stupid, and the police will give us the benefit of the doubt more often than not. Now, we might go to jail. We might spend the night in jail, or we might have to go and face a courtroom. But more often than not, we are given the benefit of the doubt. Black people, and particularly black males, and other people of color, but particularly black males, are not given the benefit of the doubt. They are not allowed to make mistakes. And if they happen to have a criminal record behind them, as many, especially in these poorer communities, many young black males do have criminal records because they're over-policed, and the police will stick anything they can to them. Any mistakes they have on their record are justification to use the most extreme force possible. And there's some argument whether that's, you know, because police are afraid of what they perceive as criminals, or whether police are looking for excuses to kill. I think depending on how you perceive policing, you feel a little bit differently. I used to feel that police just were reacting in fear, but I don't know. The more I read about these cases, and the more I'm following these cases that are even going on just here in St. Louis, the more I'm wondering if police aren't looking for opportunities to pop a few shots off every now and then, because they sure do seem to be doing it an awful lot.
Yeah, there was a documentary on PBS that you can get on YouTube, and I'll put up in the show notes, called Slavery by Another Name. And it was sort of the Michelle Alexander approach to, you know, institutionalized prison industrial complex. But it went a little bit further back. And there's a few things that I found, I want to say, fascinating, but they really connected the dots effectively. But when slavery ended, Emancipation Proclamation, all of a sudden there was a large area in the South that lost a free workforce. Right? It, you know, now they needed a way for their plantations and whatnot to be able to operate. And you could see it. You could look at the chart across the year. As soon as harvest came, right, all of a sudden it's August, the number of black individuals arrested on just bogus, you know, things like vagrancy, loitering, and they'd get arrested, and they'd have a $12 or $13 fine, and 18, you know, 70, whatever, and they couldn't pay it, so they had to go to prison for so many months, and then the prisons would send these individuals on, you know, trains to the plantations, and they'd, so, you know, as a plantation owner, you went from slavery, where you had to, not you had to, where you were keeping somebody under your control. This was almost more, from a business perspective, this form of slavery by name was even better, right? So now there's somebody else keeping them locked up. There's somebody else feeding these free labored workforce. They're coming to my farm to do the work, and I can pay them, you know, ridiculously low wages because they're in prison. And it allows me to keep down wages, allows me to, as an owner of this business, to not have unionized efforts, to not be able to pay other people more money. It's a form of peonage that was very rampant, very rampant. You can just see it. You know, here's the books. Here's the number of black people incarcerated under arrest. Here comes August, and it skyrockets. And I'm not saying that's exactly what's happening today, but as a general sort of meta description, the state-run method of profiting off of black individuals, in particular with regards to imprisonment and you know, bullshit charges and fines and fees, it's, you know, it's hard to not say that it seems deliberate. And in that instance, I don't know if killing an individual is likewise deliberate, but my God, you know, it certainly, to me, it seems like there's a direct correlation between profiting off of individuals of color.
Yes. Well, and with regard to Ladarius, you know, I don't know specifically you know, what his story with the police was. I mean, I know what details we've been able to uncover. I don't know if he was in a situation where he was legitimately being targeted by police because he was, you know, running with a bad crowd and doing things he shouldn't be, or if he was just someone that the police happened to be picking on all the time. I do know that I've heard other black men who have had situations like his talk about how the harassment from police is constant. And once you get a record, the police pretty much just follow you wherever you go. They'll stop and frisk you on a dime. They treat you like a criminal, whether you're behaving like a criminal or not. And it makes it really hard for them to carry about their business because they're constantly looking over their shoulder, not for other people to come and hurt them from their community, but from police who they don't really know, who aren't really a part of their community, but who are there watching them, following them, treating them as if they are going to commit a crime at any moment.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine, you know, what that's like. And, you know, we've had similar cases here in St. Louis as well. We had Antonio Martin back at the beginning of this year.
Yeah.
A very similar case. You know, he was at a gas station, and all of a sudden police say he pulled a gun on an officer, and the officer pulled out a gun and shot him. And, you know, it didn't make any sense for Martin to pull out a gun at a gas station where he was in front of a bunch of cameras and there was a cop that had just rolled up. But yet, that was the narrative that they pushed, and that was the narrative that they were happy to have everyone believe. And, you know, they even made sure that there was a conspicuous gun out on the crime scene a couple hours after it happened, just so that they could back their story up.
Yeah.
Even though many people said that gun mysteriously appeared, it wasn't initially there.
Sorry, but if I remember correctly, with Antonio's case, there's a lot of weird things, but again, to sort of how the media and the police and they're working in concert to frame this narrative, they raise so that I believe there were multiple cameras at this gas station, a place that would have lots of, you know, camera angles and views. They released two videos that were from a monumental distance. You couldn't see anything. In one, it actually looks like he was pulling out a cell phone. It looks like there's a flash of light that would be a screen. But for me, I couldn't see or make out anything. You just couldn't see anything at all. And every, you know, I don't want to paint like right-wing nut jobs, but everybody that's opposed to this sort of social change, everyone that has this implicit bias, looked at that video as some sort of like racially Rorschach something or other. And they would say like, look, he's got a gun. There's a gun. You can see a gun. I'm like, I've seen this video. I've rewound it. I've zoomed it in. I don't know what you're seeing, but I don't see a goddamn gun. You know, it was just bizarre that people would see that you could see two people could look and see the same thing. And as clear as the nose on my face, I don't see shit. 20 people are telling me, look, there's a gun. And it's like, your implicit bias is so strong that this grainy, murky Rorschach racial bias test is telling you confirmation of your bias that this person had a gun. You know what I mean? It was weird.
Absolutely. Well, and this is where getting back to the media, you know, here in St. Louis, we have a real problem with it. There's a certain reporter, her name's Christine Byers, and she's a police reporter, and she pretty much serves as a mouthpiece to the police. And I know we mentioned her in previous weeks, but it's worth drawing attention to her because yesterday, right after Ladarius Williams was killed, she was immediately posting up tweets saying what she was going to be putting in her story, and they were things that had come straight from the police.
Of course.
They were things that, you know, I mean, she was tweeting them out just to get on the record that she had talked to the police and this is what they had told her. And there was no investigation. She didn't go and talk to the family. She didn't go and talk to the potential witnesses. And by the way, there's also a weird story from yesterday about this came to me by way of Keith Rose, who's one of the local protesters, who is very reputable. He's also white, but he's involved with the jail support. He's very reputable about everything he says. Keith said that there was a witness that police harassed and then shoved into a car and didn't take a statement from. And the witness actually had seen what happened. And there were other people on the scene that that confirmed that this person was a witness and had seen it. And they confirmed that the police had basically started beating him and you know, treating him really badly as soon as he started protesting that he had seen what happened. So there's even some weird stuff there going on. But do you see our mainstream media and our established media here in the area reporting on any of that? No, they don't cover that. What they do instead is they print what the police department says as an authoritative source, and then they do no digging.
Yeah.
Whatsoever. The only digging they'll do is into the background of the person that was killed, the victim.
Yeah.
And this becomes a problem because this is not how things happen when white people are killed by police. And I can say this because I've been going through the Killed by Police data. KilledByPolice.net is a website that just tracks anyone that's been killed by a police officer. And in 2014, there were 1,100 people that were killed by police officers. Now, some of these cases were things where the people, you know, they were doing what's called suicide by cop, you know, where they basically walk up to a cop and pull the gun or, you know, threaten the cop and they got killed. Some of them were white, some of them were black. Some of them were other groups as well. But what's interesting is that whenever you read about white people that have been in these situations, unless they are people that are just really, really obvious criminals, I mean, people that look like they're part of a, you know, a Hollywood movie about criminals.
Right.
Most of the time, they're talked about in pretty nice or neutral ways. They'll talk about how, you know, they were struggling with mental health issues,
absolutely,
or how they were having a difficult time, you know, with their drug addiction, or, you know, they'll say things like that.
Yeah.
If it's a black person, no matter what the context, it's almost always they had a criminal record, they had a history of violence, you know, they pulled a weapon on an officer and the officer responded, as was his right to do. You know, they'll take the side of the police officer almost immediately, regardless of the context of the situation.
Yeah.
And that kind of reporting is concerning because it shows such a lack of interest in even beginning to unpack the details of these cases. And the fact of the matter is, now that there are so many people protesting these situations, there are a lot of details that never make it into the mainstream media and established media sources. They're only things that you'll find in the new media where people are doing their own independent investigation.
Agreed. And in fact, I pulled up, so we're talking about, and I want to get back to Christine DeBuyer in a moment, but so we're talking about how the media narrative and frames you know, individuals that are white that have, you know, whether it's killed by a cop. So there's one you told me about in Texas, Christina Coynard. Is that it? Christina Coynard? And I pulled it up on the AP. And literally, this is the first thing, you know, Google search, the AP, first thing that comes up. And, you know, I'm looking through the description of her. And, you know, she went into the police. She called and asked for police assistance and then mysteriously pulled some weapon, which they haven't said what it was, and kind of attacked these officers, perhaps, you know, suicide by cop. But right away, you know, they're talking about Robertson said her niece struggled with depression, bipolar disorder. You know, she's had these issues 4 years old. She's been hospitalized. You know, she suffered from mental illness, had to cry for help. Nothing about any of her past. You know, who knows if she had run into the police. We don't want to know those things about white people. That's not how they frame it. That's not the language that comes out.
And let's talk, too, about the picture that they ran. So, by the way, Christina Coynard featured in freaking People magazine. I mean, I've never seen People magazine report about a black victim. I mean, unless there was something really big going on, like Ferguson or Eric Garner, something like that, where they're talking about it after the fact. But she was there. People magazine actually wrote a little article about her. And as with most of the other sources, what they ran was they ran cute pictures of her from her social media accounts where she's wearing glasses and smiling at the camera and looks like a cute 17-year-old girl. Almost invariably, when you see a black victim, the first picture you're going to see of them is a mugshot or a picture of them flashing a gang sign or holding a weapon or something like that. I mean, it's almost always a disrespectful, bottom-of-the-barrel kind of picture that is meant to tell you right away, oh, yeah, they're a criminal. You don't need to worry about their passing. They deserved what they got.
Yeah, that's the message they're trying to send, right? So there's the narrative, the frame, the narrative, and the message. The message is Mike Brown was a bad guy. He was a thug. And I'm looking at, like you said, the picture, Christina. She's got, you know, like you said, cute glasses, little peace sign. She was 17. She's a young girl. Mike was 18. He's a man. You know, it's just they're not subtle, but they're persistent and consistent differences in the language, the words, and the way in which we as a society, let's not just say media, we as a society talk about individuals that are victims of police violence that are white versus black. And we're going to talk in maybe about 10 minutes towards the end of the podcast about what, you know, individuals can do. And that was one of the, as I was new to Twitter, one of the things I thought was amazing after Mike's death, Mike Brown's murder, was the "if they gunned me down" hashtag. So they had, you know, people of color saying, well, what picture would they choose? Because remember, Mike Brown, you could have had a picture of him in his graduation cap and gown. You could have had all kinds of pictures, but they ran pictures with, you know, making him out look like a bad person. So people of color were doing all sorts of, you know, what picture would they choose? And they have side by side, me with my, you know, wife and kids, or, you know, me in a picture from social media that, you know, could be construed to make me look in a bad light. And I thought that was very powerful as a mechanism to sort of highlight the hypocrisy. I think Twitter's been, in particular, hashtagging and doing things like that wonderful. But sorry to interrupt you. You were still talking about Christina and sort of the media narrative and how they painted her.
Well, and I think it's where I was going was the crime that she committed was going into a police station armed with a knife and attacking three police officers. That itself was not something that was probably deserving of being shot to death, because the knife that she had was not in any way threatening to them, and she was a 17-year-old girl. But the fact is that she actually exhibited violent, erratic behavior, very typical of someone that does have mental illness problems that decides that they're going to be violent. And she really did do something that was questionable and objectionable, and she is reported on in this very favorable light, whereas we have these black victims that many times, if it weren't for the fact that the media immediately portrays them as bad people, they're actually pretty decent people, and they didn't appear to really do anything other than just get on the wrong side of a cop on a bad day. And they are immediately vilified. They're never given the benefit of the doubt. They're never looked upon as being potentially innocent. And it gets even more complicated when they're people who are being served warrants at their home. Yeah. I mean, again, you never know if these warrants are real or if they're just for some trumped up, situation like a parking ticket or something like that. They could be people like Darian Hunt, who just had the audacity to wear a costume from his favorite anime show, you know, a show about samurai, and he's wearing a costume and a toy sword, and that was enough for police to decide he needed to be killed, and that was enough for media to immediately smear him and make him look terrible before they ever tried to figure out why he was carrying a samurai sword in public. Yeah. You know, the difference is stark, and it's something that we, as people who are aware, people that have privilege, people that are paying attention to this stuff, we have to stop standing for it. We have to stop allowing media to report this way and to be unaccountable, because one of the biggest problems that we have is that they're writing for a readership that's very vocally on the other side. And I can say that with some authority, because I've done a lot of reading of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, for example, comments, and I have never seen so much racist drivel as I see in those comment threads sometimes. You know, talking about these victims as being thugs who deserve what they had, and how, you know, they would have been in jail anyway, and, you know, this is saving us money from having to institutionalize them, and, you know, all kinds of just horrible, horrible things. That's the audience that these media sources are writing for. That's the audience that's vocal. That's the audience that's telling them what they want to hear. And we have to stand up against that. We have to demand that they do a better job.
Yeah. And I've said before that the sort of notion that police infallibility, they're humans, they make mistakes, but police infallibility, it's just, we treat it like it's beyond reproach. It's just, you know, it's sacrosanct. You can't even talk about it. They put their lives on the line. You know, they're never wrong. And it's fostered an environment where they're able to act with impunity. There's no accountability. There's no trust. That lack of trust has created even more problems. Now it's little, and I believe the sort of culture of, you know, not wanting to talk to the police, you know, don't be snitching, whatever. It's exacerbated when the police are acting in an unaccountable way with impunity. And it's just insane. And now when the protest movement is demanding this level of accountability, it's deemed as an attack. It's like an affrontal, you know, attack. Like they're turning their backs on de Blasio. It's just, it's unbelievable. And so to the point that, you know, who are they writing for? And, you know, back to Christine de Byers, she, in my opinion, is so obviously tainted. You know, it's like, follow the money. What does she do? She writes crime books. She's a crime, you know, like a real crime author. She makes money off of writing these true crime stories. How does she get information for true crime stories? Having a connection with the police. How does she maintain and keep a connection with the police? Tweeting and writing all the stuff they want to. You called her a mouthpiece. I think she's a PR branch for the police. I mean, when Mike Brown was killed, she had that tweet that got retweeted like 10,000 times about, I think it was 12 different eyewitnesses corroborate the Darren Wilson side of the story. And at the time, she wasn't even working, right? She was on, like, leave. I don't know what was. But
it was maternity leave.
Yeah. So here she's misrepresenting herself, misrepresenting her platform, misrepresenting the facts, and she's done it repeatedly and consistently. And I don't want to say I don't believe anything she says. All she does is pick up the phone, hear what the police officer says, and then reports it. And then she reports it in a way and a voice as if it were actual, like, fact and journalistic reporting, not hearsay given to her through the telephone. You know what I mean? And people read it, and they read it as, oh, this is fact. I'm going to just accept this as fact. And to the same – and I don't – you know, I'm not trying to be anti-police. I don't – anybody, you know, write into the show and say, you know, Drew hates cops. That's not the case. That's not the case. But this lack of trust is significant. And as social media and live streaming and cameras and video has become more and more popular, and that – information is getting out and being disseminated, we're catching police officers in a multitude of lies, and not even a little one. The lies with Mike Brown's distance from the SUV, the lie about Kajimi Powell, lunging. There's just, you know, the lie about Tamir Rice. There's all these things where the police come out and they say, and in particular, if they don't know that they've been taped, right? If they try to get their story out and it's like, oh shit, somebody had a cell phone we didn't know about. It's almost always catching them in a lie. And so you wonder, seems pretty obvious to me why they cordon off the crime scene, why they push protesters away and don't want anything filmed, why they're so closing of the ranks and trying to get the story out quickly and efficiently, because they don't want to – that's how you I forget who said it, but if you want to tell a lie, tell it, you know, vociferously, loudly, and boldly, you know? And that's kind of what seems like it's happening. And I personally, anytime I hear the sort of – you know, you said in the beginning, what does this case sound like? It sounds a lot like, you know, Von Derrick Myers. Every time I hear this, you know, feared for my life, reached for a gun, saw a gun, you know, struggle, I kind of feel like not all of it's bullshit, but man, I don't buy any of it. You know, I really don't. And maybe I'm a cynic and it's just, that's just me, but those narratives and stories are far too similar, far too consistent, persistent. And, you know, it's like for me to believe that, I have to believe that an individual, a black person who, let's use the most recent case, a black person who's already been to jail, already been shot by a cop, we're now to believe that, you know, he went crazy and pulled a gun and, you know, ran and all this stuff. I don't know. It just seems all, you know, if it were all true, it'd be the biggest fucking coincidence in the history of the earth. You know, it can't be all true. And we know it. There's cases where police officers have planted guns on people. There are cases where they've lied. They never get in trouble, but we know that these are, you know, there are mistakes, and that they attempt to cover those mistakes up. And there's a multitude of reasons, from avoiding civil liabilities, the, you know, FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, but it's just getting to the point where, you know, it's disgusting. It's my reaction. And I don't know, you know, I think we're going to talk in a little bit about what to do, and we're maybe at the 45 minute mark, but I did you hear about Alicia Alampi in Syracuse yesterday? Have you been aware of this case?
I'm sorry. Could you say that again?
her name is Alicia Alampi. She's a white woman that was in Syracuse. And on December 13th, she was leaving an area that's got some bars, and she was inebriated. She was drunk. And she had a state patrol officer following her. Okay, so she's drunk, and she's wealthy and elite and white, and she's got friends within the department, and they're following her. And I assume ostensibly so that she doesn't get a DUI. Oh, she's a little drunk. I'll just follow you, make sure you're safe. Earlier that evening, another individual, and I forget his name, Rob had left, and he was also inebriated. He'd been drinking, and he's walking, and she runs him over, kills him, right? Hits him in the road, runs him over. She stops at some point after she hits Rob, and her and the police officer, the state trooper, say that they looked around and they couldn't really see anything, and they kind of, you know, they thought maybe she hit an animal, so they kept going. This is what they say. And there's a lot of mysterious, you know, what damage was to her car, not to her car, but some of the leaked information said there was blood on the hood, blood on the roof, blood on the windshield, that the grill was all smashed up. Like, I've run over a squirrel, and I knew what I did, and I was heartbroken, and I could tell, and it was a squirrel. I don't see how you hit a human being and not have these sort of and the police officers there and they didn't see Robert's body in the road, and then, you know, 20 minutes later a tow truck's driving down the road and sees Robert's body, and, you know, now the police are involved, so forth and so on. But so she was drunk. She admitted being drunk. She blew many hours later over the legal limit, 0.12, right? So Robert's dead. She's drunk. She was driving. I just, in my history, that seems so cut and dry. You're drunk, you kill somebody, you're guilty. They're just, I don't know many times when you can be drunk, admit that you're drunk, kill somebody, and literally get acquitted. She got off of the manslaughter and homicide charges. She got charged by the jury for DWI, but she got acquitted for killing Robert. And it, and even worse, we're talking about the sort of the narrative and the framing. As you're reading the stories and the reports in the analysis, and I think it was the Syracuse.com publication, they described how Alicia's inebriation, and they did it in a sort of slick way, but her inebriation was used as a, you know, you talk about white people getting the benefit of the doubt. Her being drunk was used as a, well, she didn't know, she wouldn't have known if she hit somebody. It was used as sort of a, to give her a pass. Whereas Robert's inebriation, same, you know, they're both drinking, was used as a way to smear him as the victim. Oh, he was maybe drunk and fell down and was lying in the middle of the street. He was drunk and was wandering. And you should hear the shit. They were talking about the lights were, it was really dark and they couldn't see anything. He was wearing dark clothing. And it's like, at what point does it really fucking matter that he was wearing dark clothing and it was dark out? She was drunk. She was behind the wheel of a vehicle. There was a state trooper behind her and they killed a man. And I just, you know, it's insane to me. It's absolutely insane that the abject hypocrisy and disparity with which, and for white people to look at these things and not see it, it just, I want to shake white people by the shoulder. And I don't know, you know, how other white people kind of come to the conclusion that this was okay. But for me, I can see sort of the bigger picture. It's like, well, okay, you know, what happened? She's white. She's got money. She's got a lawyer. She's got every opportunity. Every benefit of the doubt is afforded to her. She killed a man, went home, showered, was able to walk to the police station, turn herself in later. She never spent a day in jail. The prosecutor has some level of discretion as to how aggressively to prosecute her, what charges to levy against her, what we, as we saw in the grand jury in first Ferguson, the prosecutor has an awful lot of control as to everything that gets done within the case. And then the judge,
it's 10 o'clock.
The judge has discretion. The judge decides what evidence is admitted and not admitted, what objections are, you know, sustained versus overruled. It's just, you know, at every instance, at every turn, there is privilege and preferential treatment for white people. And at the end of the day, you know, when people talk about, you know, due process and justice, it's like, you know, it's just us, white people, because it's not just, you know, it's just, it's not a just world when it comes to the application of law. And people, they believe that it is, you know, there's people that will tell me to this day about Mike Brown. Oh, shut up. What are you talking about? You know, there was a trial, you know, they even get that wrong. No, it wasn't a trial. It was a grand jury. Oh, he was acquitted. No. He just wasn't indicted. A trial would have been nice. We would have had some cross-examination. We didn't even get that. You know, and then they'll say like, oh, but, you know, what do you want? What do you want? Well, I'd like a prosecutor that didn't put known liars in the grand jury room, the people that weren't even there in the grand jury room. I'd like a police department that doesn't release dog whistle videos to smear the victim and sully the jury pool before it's even selected. You know, all kinds of things need to change, but it's becoming. My wife at one point said, if this were a TV show, it would have been canceled years ago. It's a horrible TV show. It's, you know, it's on repeat. It's awful. So we've talked for about 48 minutes, and I'm committed to getting you back to Stacey and your life. So I want to round it up. So we've talked about, you know, narratives and framing and the fact that this is happening. And I think step one for me has been understanding this and being aware of it so that I'm prepared, so that when I see the media machine spinning this narrative out, I'm a step ahead. Here's what they're going to do. They're going to start, you know, Darius, I'm going to know about his criminal record. I'm going to know about all this stuff before I know anything about his death or killing or any of the circumstances around that evening. I'm going to know all about him as an individual and his behavior. And we don't even ask why, right? We just spit that information out. So for me, step one has always been kind of knowing the playbook. And if I know the playbook, I'm a little bit, I'm not caught off guard. I don't buy it. You know, the smoke screen doesn't work on me. So that for me has always been step one. What do you think in terms of, you know, again, we're on the White Privilege podcast. Certainly there's, you know, people of color, but maybe specifically non-people of color that want to be in solidarity with the Black Lives Movement. What can we all do to help dispel and combat this cycle of killing followed by media narratives that smear the victim?
Well, the first thing we can do is not be numb. And I'm saying that because there's been a lot of talk, especially on Twitter lately, about how numbing this experience has been. Many of us that are involved in the Ferguson protests have been doing this for 8 months now, and there have been a lot of killings. By lots of killings around the country, but even here in St. Louis, you know, we've had, in the last 8 months, we've had at least six, there actually might be seven, that we've been talking about. And, you know, there are so many killings that you start to lose track after a while, but we have to not get numb as a result of the overwhelming amount of stories that we have to keep track of. We have to continue to be interested and continue to care. And you said earlier, and this is something that I preach all the time, if we say Black Lives Matter, it doesn't mean the Black lives that we think are worth saving matter. It means Black Lives Matter, period. And it doesn't matter even if the person was a horrible criminal who was a cop killer and who, you know, pulled a machine gun on a cop. You know what? There are white people that have been in that situation that have gotten taken in alive and gotten to face trial. And one that comes to mind is a guy named Eric Fried, who was captured in a manhunt. A thousand police officer manhunt, you know, was going out looking for him all over Pennsylvania. It cost them millions of dollars to find him, and they took him alive, even though he had already killed two cops.
I was going to say, that's here in my – I live in that area. He, like you said, he went in – he didn't just kill two cops. He attacked a police station. He went in like Rambo and ambushed a police station and killed two troopers. And you're right, it was months and months and months and months. And he got arrested without incident. They didn't fire a fucking shot.
So we have to be aware that that is an option. And we have to be sensitive to the fact that people are dying, and we can't be numb to that. We have to acknowledge it and say, this cannot continue. No matter how bad of a person they are, if they're a black person, they deserve to stand trial. The second thing is, whenever these cases are breaking, we need to document as much information as we can on our own social media, just taking our own notes. A tool that I love to use is called Storify. It's a free tool where you can write things, you can put tweets in, you can put web content in, all in one page, and then you can share it. It's kind of like a news story, but it's really dynamic and interesting. Every time one of these cases goes down, I Storify every tweet I can find from people that are investigating or that were on the scene or that are talking to witnesses. We here in St. Louis are blessed to have a number of protesters that immediately head out to the scene and get a lot of information. And they do that because the police lie. And this is how we catch them in lies, is by getting information right up front. And the more of that we can preserve, the more we have ammunition to do the third action, which is holding the media accountable. Now, this is an area where I am not doing a very good job right now, but I want to do a better job. And that is, once we've collected this information, writing the media sources and really pressing them. Why are you not talking about this angle? Why are you not talking about this aspect of the case? Why are you not reporting all of the facts? And, you know, regardless of whether or not they listen to us, they need to feel that pressure from us. They need to be told they're not doing their job. And, you know, here in St. Louis, we have some photojournalists that work for the St. Louis paper that are incredible journalists. They go out and they really cover everything. And, in fact, Robert Cohn, who's one of the photojournalists that's covered a lot of Ferguson, was out yesterday covering Ladarius Williams. And he was getting pictures of what was really happening. And if you look at his pictures and you juxtapose them with the articles that were written, completely different. I mean, his pictures are showing the anguish and the agony of the people that were on the scene, and the articles don't even make reference to those folks. So it's startling how even among the journalists that are reporting this, if you have people that do care about this and that do want to do a good job, they will, but they need the support and they need the pressure to be doing their job correctly.
Yeah.
So those three actions, I think, are really crucial, and especially as these cases are going on all over the country, and there are people that want to be involved in what we're doing all over the country, paying attention to your local beat, making sure that you understand what's going on, and really being a voice for it in those ways can help a lot.
Yeah, there's an example, and I can't remember the young man's name, but do you remember the sometime after Ferguson, sometime after Mike Brown's extrajudicial killing, there was a young black male that had a sign that said, like, you know, free hugs, and there was a hug that he gave a cop, and there was this picture that kind of went viral, and it was on CNN, and, you know, it was sort of this, look, we're healing, and everything's peace and love, and that went around for a good, you know, maybe like 2 weeks, and it wasn't widely distributed, but I found it through Tumblr. There was somebody on scene that was also a photographer that took, just like you're saying, this individual is, so you can go to this crime scene and you can take pictures of the person that's been killed, the, you know, stains of blood and, you know, all sorts of gory, horrific things, or you can take pictures of the agony and pain that are on the faces of the, you know, loved ones of this individual that's just been killed. And it's up to you to decide, you know, what do you want to do, what's the story that you think your audience wants, and, you know, what is appropriate. But so the young man that's giving this cop a hug, the shot, the image was a really tight image of this young man giving a hug. And the photographer had a different shot that put this on Tumblr that was a little bit further away. And it, all of a sudden, the scene changed. You didn't need any words. You just remember the picture we saw with the kid hugging the cop? Now let's look at a picture from about 10 feet further back. It was a goddamn circus. He was surrounded by like 30 photographers. It was staged, right? It was clearly staged. Let's get this, you know, kid. He's got a sign, free hugs. And the person that had this photo from further away said, hey, you know what? I saw him talking to his mom. He was in tears. He didn't want to give this cop a hug. He didn't want to do it at all. And the mom's saying, oh, we're going to do this, and they're going to take a picture or do that. So, you know, I think, like you said, keeping them accountable, documenting this stuff. And I likewise haven't done a sufficient job of actually writing to publications. I was very hard on Christine DeBuyers and CNN when they kept running Josie. Every goddamn time I saw Josie's name in a friggin' CNN, I'm like, you know what? She is a known. This doesn't exist. The Josie caller into this fake radio show is complete horseshit. Why do you keep running it? And just, you know, over and over and over again, whether it did anything, I don't know. But one of the things that I would also add, maybe to kind of what you've described, and I think it's a very appropriate encapsulation of what, you know, we non-people of color or just anyone in this movement can do to sort of dispel this narrative, but also amplifying, right? So letting people know, and that's retweeting and, like you said, captioning with Storify. Within my circle, you know, my mom, my brothers, and some friends, I tend to be viewed as a little bit more connected to some of this. So they literally come to me. Hey, what happened with this? You know, what's going on with that? And I heard about this. And some of this stuff, you know, like talking about Mike Brown and the information that we know and, you know, various things. There's that one really great, I forget who does it, but the Neurobomb website. You know, the inconsistencies, errors, lies, it's almost like you do need a three-ring binder and a wiki and a search tool to keep track of all of it. You know, to expect one person to know every little detail is to be, you know, an expert on Mike Brown's killing. And that's a lot. You know, that's, and there's 1,100 of these last year. You're not going to be an expert on everyone. But what you do know, I think in particular as a white person, I feel very obligated to compress that into a digestible post of information that I share, and I tag people. You know, I'll write something on Facebook. I'm almost never on Facebook, and I'll tag my mom and friends and other people because I want them to know. You know, I said, listen, you know, whether you're going to do anything with this, whether, you know, you're a white individual that's in a stage where you're apathetic and your head's buried in the sand, I don't know. But if one person has a question, I want them to be able to have some answers and be able to not, you know, continue spreading the media narrative of bullshit. I want them to have the tools to be able to dispel that. And I think as an individual that's, you know, I spend some time within this space, so they've come to me frequently. Hey, you know, Drew, what about this? What about that? So I feel very you know, like I said, obligated to be able to be aware and be able to communicate that information. And then, you know, my mom, God bless her, she'll, you know, I heard about this and what about that? And she'll take what I said and some articles and she'll send them to friends one by one. You know, she'll send an email. Well, this just happened. I don't know if you heard about this and this is what's going on and don't believe that. And it's like, that's fantastic. And it might not be scalable, my mom talking to people one by one, but it's a start. It's something, you know?
Well, and let me also say that, and what you're describing, absolutely we all need to be doing, and it's something that we all can always be looking for opportunities to do better. So let me also close out our discussion here by reminding this as well. If we don't speak up and we don't draw attention to the fact that there is more to the story than what's being reported, then we leave two things that we really don't want. First of all, we leave the media distorted view as being the true authoritative view. There's no dissent, so nobody questions. The second thing is, do you know what they did leave behind when they left that scene yesterday in the Dutchtown neighborhood in St. Louis after they killed Ladarius Williams? They blocked the scene off for a few hours. What they left behind, of course, were distraught neighbors and family members who, you know, were aware of what was going on, but what they also left behind was a big bloody stain in the gangway. They didn't clean it up. They didn't do anything to rope it off. They just left it there. And one might argue that they left it there because they wanted it to serve as a warning. They wanted it to remind people in the neighborhood that we can kill you. We will kill you if we feel like we need to, and you can't do anything about it. And that, to me, is even more offensive than the bad reporting, that the police are allowed to send those kinds of messages and to get away with that kind of behavior without us speaking up about it and holding them accountable. So
yeah.
The more we are doing to document, to share, to really talk to people about what actually happened and why they should have doubt that the police acted in a reasonable and good way, the more that we can put an end to that kind of nonsense. Because to me, you know, I obviously not a member of the Black community, but were I a member of the Black community, that's exactly the way I would have perceived that bloody stain that was left in the gangway.
Yeah, just like Mike's body being left on the street for 4 hours for everyone to see. And, you know, there's a direct corollary to lynching and having like photo opportunities beneath the body, right? You're making postcards. That's what white people have done for centuries, and it's meant to terrorize and threaten, and it is a statement. It's absolutely a threat that we can do this, and it's callous, and it's just, and I think that's part of the, what I think is gonna, I hope, I really do, I believe that this movement's gonna work. I don't know if it'll be in my lifetime, but I believe it's gonna work, and I think part of why it's gonna work is because the callousness and the abject just wanton disregard that is coming from, you know, call it Joe supremacy. I don't know what you want to call the status quo, the powers that be, whatever it is, but, you know, and it's not an individual, it's everybody. They, you know, the police, all these things happen. There's a level of just wanton disregard for humanity and a callousness that I'll just speak for me. I'll use an I statement. I've been aware of systemic issues. I've been aware of the prison industrial complex. My wife worked here in New Jersey on a legislative issue to ban the box and do some other things for 3 years. She was going to meetings by herself. I said to her, I said, honey, I think the problem's too big. I don't think, you know, I don't know. I don't know what to do. It's too big. We're not going to be able to solve it. So I didn't do anything. I was one of the asleep at the wheel, apathetic, you know, aware, but not active white people. And absolutely, unquestionably, Mike Brown's death and my connection via Twitter to that real-time, immediate information that dispelled the narrative, that, you know, disseminated, you know, more of the information that I could parcel myself and make a decision based on what I think to be facts rather than what the media tell me, it's turned me into an activist. It woke me up in a way that, you know, I say I'm woke up, fed up, and I'm not going to shut up. And the more they keep acting in this way, the more they're waking people up. And I think it's going to be their downfall. I hope, you know, I hope that we can, as activists and people working in this movement, I shouldn't say activists, I'm just a dude, but people working in this space, I hope that we can use the tools that you and I have talked about to highlight these issues and highlight these incidents of just, you know, wanton disregard for Black life.
Yes. And, anyhow, I think that we have done a very good job of unpacking this particular death, but I think that we need to stay vigilant about just looking for more opportunities to continue to document these terrible things that the police have been doing. And again, you know, if we find ourselves getting numb, you know, there is a time and a place for self-care. It happens. And, you know, everyone here in the protest community feels that that's something that we need to engage in from time to time. But we need to get right back in the game and continue documenting these things with a passion afterwards. Because if we don't speak up, who's going to? And we in the white community in particular need to be speaking up, because the black community has been speaking up for an awful long time without being listened to.
Yeah.
It's our turn.
Yeah, and that's probably another episode in terms, too, of just the importance of white people speaking up. I've seen it in my own life that, you know, the message is received by other white people differently when the delivery is from a white person versus a person of color. But that's we're over the hour, and I want to make sure we keep this a tight hour so we can do it again next week. But, Sean, thank you so much. I'll remind everyone you can find us on Stitcher, iTunes. Our website's The Interracial John, JAWN. It's under White Privilege Podcast. Thank you for your time, and thanks, Stacy, for allowing you to spend this time with us. But we'll go ahead and end the show.
It's always a pleasure. Happy to do it again.
And remember, help don't hinder, support don't supplant, cooperate don't co-opt, solidarity not charity. One person can make a difference. Your passion is a superpower.